On behalf of the University of Melbourne, it's a delight to welcome you to this, the inaugural Derek Denton Lecture in Science and the Arts. And I'd like to commence this evening's lecture in the traditional way by acknowledging the first owners of the land on which we meet, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Tonight we will hear from one of the most distinguished cosmologists on the planet, and I hope you will accept that description. I mean, of course, the President of the Royal Society, Lord Martin Rees. But before introducing him, may I say just a little about the purpose of this evening. As many of you are aware, in Professor Derek Denton, the University of Melbourne boasts one of the great contributors and achievers of medical science in the 20th and 21st century. Professor Denton is the founder of the world-renowned Howard Florey Institute. He's done truly groundbreaking research in basic biology, including vital work on the body's use of salt. Much of that work was reported in his classic book, The Hunger for Salt, which was described by a professor from Harvard University as the best example of integrative physiology to come out of the second half of the 20th century. That quotation gives just a small indication of just how highly regarded is the work of Derek Denton. And another measure of that international respect is his early election in 1974 as a foreign medical member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, a busy academy since amongst its duties it must choose the winners of the Nobel Prize each year. The University of Melbourne is rightly proud of the achievements of Professor Derek Denton, and we proudly own him as an alumnus. With his spouse, Dame Margaret Scott, Professor Denton has been an outstanding contributor, not just to science, but to the arts in Australia for many years, something recognised in the Australia Day 2005 honours when Derek was made a companion in the Order of Australia for service to science and the arts. With great generosity, he's decided to endow the university with funds for a continuing lecture series which will bring speakers of truly global stature to the university. And these lectures, he hopes, will alternate between science and the arts, the two cultures famously spoken of by C.P. Snow. This lecture series will bring an outstanding, indeed a world-leading scholar and thinker across a range of disciplines to the Melbourne community and will be, I'm sure, an important part of the life of this university. Please join me in thanking Professor Derek Denton. And in his choice of inaugural lecturer, Lord Rees, Derek has done us proud. We're enormously grateful for the work that Lord Rees has put into the School of Physics and elsewhere in this university in recent days. He's well known by reputation to many of us this evening. He's, of course, the President of the Royal Society, Astronomer Royal, Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, and without doubt, one of the acclaimed Masters of Science Communication today. He's the author or co-author of more than 500 research papers, mainly on astrophysics and cosmology, 7 books, 5 of them aimed for a general readership, and countless articles and magazine and newspaper contributions on scientific and more general subjects. He's the author of many memorable lines, as readers discovered in a recent interview in The Age, expressing his great concern about nuclear arms control. He said he's anxious to ensure that humans don't destroy the book of life before they have read it. And perhaps even more pungently, he commented on people who misuse information technology, such as the designer of computer viruses, saying, "The village idiot, the village, global village must have its village idiots." He delivered it much better than I did. He holds numerous awards, including the Crawford Prize from the Royal Swedish Academy. And yesterday, the University of Melbourne acknowledged his achievements by awarding him a rare Doctor of Science honoris causa. He's indeed one of the most distinguished scientists of the day and the most appropriate person to deliver the inaugural Derek Denton Lecture in Science and the Arts. Please make welcome Lord Martin Rees.
Chancellor, Vice-Chancellor, Governor, Prime Minister, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, Let me first say what a great pleasure and privilege it is for me to be here today. And I would like to add my tribute to Derek Denton. It is certainly because of him that I am here. And I think this university is fortunate to have someone who is not only a great scientist, but a great humanist and great scholar. And I'm delighted to be inaugurating a lecture series in his name. Can we turn the lights down a little bit? Please, to see your slides better. I'm not going to give a sermon, but I am going to start with a text. And my text is the famous closing words of Darwin's Origin of Species. That's better, yes. Whilst this planet has been cycling on, according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, forms most wonderful have been and are being evolved. Darwin's simple beginning, the young Earth with its complex chemistry and geology cycling on in its orbit, is itself a very complicated system. And astronomers aim to probe back still further and to set our entire solar system in a broader expanse of space and time. And we've made some progress. We can understand how, starting from some still mysterious genesis event nearly 14 billion years ago, atoms, galaxies, stars and planets emerged. And on at least one planet, our Earth, life began, and Darwinian selection led to the emergence of creatures able to ponder their origins, the wonder and the mystery. That happened here. We don't know if it happened anywhere else. I'll try to highlight this evening some themes that seem specially interesting today and which confront astronomers with challenges for the coming decades. I can't claim to be much of a visionary myself. I sometimes get asked for horoscopes, but I tell people they couldn't afford them. But my next picture shows someone who was a visionary. Many of you will recognize him. That's Arthur C. Clarke. He lived in Sri Lanka, and he died in 2007, age 90. Clarke said that his greatest wish was to see the discovery of alien life. And sadly, he didn't. But he did live long enough to see human life venture beyond the Earth. He wasn't, of course, the first person to think about space travel. Among his precursors was the great Isaac Newton, the most distinguished alumnus of my Cambridge College. So I'll give him a plug. But I have to say he was a most unattractive character compared to Darwin. He was solitary and obsessive when young, vain and vindictive when older. So a most unpleasant man. But in the English version of his great work, Principia, there is this picture, which I think is still the clearest way to explain the idea of orbital flight. You can see what's happening. A cannon is being fired from a mountaintop, and if it's fired fast enough, then its trajectory curves down no faster than the Earth curves away underneath it. It goes into orbit. Now, Newton could have calculated that to go into orbit, the cannon would have to be fired at 18,000 miles an hour, far beyond, of course, the feasibility of the cannon of his time. And as we know, the first to achieve that escape velocity was the Russian Sputnik in 1957. And things then developed fast in space. In the next decade, manned spaceflight went from the cornflakes packet to reality, as it were. And we saw pictures like this. Only 12 years separated Sputnik from the first moon landing. And the moon landing was only 66 years after the Wright brothers' first flight. Many of us who were then around would have expected a lunar base or even an expedition to Mars by now. But 2001 didn't resemble Clarke's vision any more than 1984, fortunately, resembled Orwell's. The Apollo program now seems a remote historical episode. Young people all over the Earth learn that America landed men on the moon. just as they learn that the Egyptians built the pyramids. But the motivations seem almost as bizarre in the one case as in the other. The impetus for manned spaceflight was lost after the 1970s. And it's 38 years since Jack Schmidt and Eugene Cernan, the last men on the moon, returned to Earth. But it was a heroic episode, and this is a precious souvenir of mine signed by 7 of the Apollo astronauts. And it was an astonishing achievement because they had at that time less computer power than in a single mobile phone, maybe even less than in a washing machine, but they got to the moon and back. Since Apollo, hundreds of astronauts have circled the Earth in low orbit, many in this space station, but none has gone further. The race to the moon was an end in itself, driven by superpower rivalry. The impetus for manned spaceflight was lost. But of course, we do now depend on space in our everyday lives. GPS, weather forecasting and communications, and robotic exploration in space, robotic without humans, has burgeoned. Indeed, unmanned probes to the other planets have beamed back pictures of varied and distinctive worlds. And let me show you some of these pictures. Here is a set of pictures of Mars. This was taken on the surface of Mars by one of the early landers. Here are views of Mars from an orbiter, showing very interesting Marscapes. This is a big crater. There it is again. And I'm going to show you a close-up of that little bit where the arrows are. There you are. This is a cliff face on Mars. And this is the arm of the Phoenix lander, the most recent probe to land on Mars, which is going to dig and analyze some of the soil. So Mars is now being studied, and probes have been further to Jupiter and its moons. The most interesting moon of Jupiter is Europa. Here's a close-up of its surface. Ice, which is believed to cover an ocean. And one of the most remarkable achievements of space flight was a probe of Saturn's giant moon, Titan. A spacecraft went to Saturn called Cassini. It then released a separate small probe called Huygens, whose aim was to do what's shown in its artist's impression, to go down to Titan, the giant moon of Saturn, which has an atmosphere, to open a parachute and do a soft landing on they knew not what. Well, it did precisely that. On the left are pictures taken on the way down. On the right is the picture where it landed. Well, there's a lake, there's what look like rivers, but there's no sort of beachfront property there. These lakes are lakes of liquid methane. The temperature's minus 160 degrees centigrade. But this probe did its job, and it was robotics, because the travel time for radio signal to Saturn is hours. So it was on its own. It wasn't being controlled from Earth. And this was a remarkable achievement of the European Space Agency, to land this probe on Saturn. Well, I hope that during the coming century, the entire solar system will be explored and mapped by flotillas of robotic craft. And maybe robots and fabricators will enable large construction projects using raw materials that need not come from the Earth. But will people follow them? I'm not sure, because the practical case for sending people into space gets ever weaker with each advance in robots and miniaturization. Indeed, as a scientist or practical man, I see little purpose in sending people into space at all. But as a human being, I'm nonetheless an enthusiast for manned missions to the moon, to the Mars, and even beyond, as a long-range adventure for at least a few humans. The next humans to walk on the moon may be Chinese. Only China seems to have the resources, the dirigiste government, and the willingness to undertake a risky Apollo-type program. But I think future expeditions to the moon and beyond apart from possibly a Chinese one, will be politically and financially feasible only if they are cut-price ventures, perhaps privately funded, spearheaded by individuals prepared to accept much higher risks than NASA can impose on civilian astronauts. The first who go to Mars may go with one-way tickets. Well, if people do go to Mars, what should they do when they get there? There are issues of environmental ethics. Would it be appropriate to exploit Mars, as happened when pioneers advanced westward across the United States? Should we send seeds for plants genetically engineered to grow and reproduce there? Or should the red planet be preserved as a natural wilderness, like the Antarctic? The answer should, I think, depend on what the pristine state of Mars actually is. If there's any life already on Mars, especially if it had different DNA, testifying to a definite separate origin from any life on Earth, then there would be widely voiced insistence that Mars should be preserved as unpolluted as possible. But it must be accepted that any manned space expedition would be dangerous. And we must remember also that nowhere in our solar system offers an environment even as clement as the Antarctic or the top of Everest. Space doesn't offer an escape from any of the Earth's problems. It's simply a place for adventurers in the long-term future. Let's now widen our gaze beyond our solar system to other stars far beyond the reach of any probe we can now conceive. We've learnt enough about the stars to understand them. We see places where new stars are forming, here in the Eagle Nebula. In that dusty cloud, there's enough material to make hundreds of new solar systems like our own. And we do see stars forming. And we see stars dying. Some die rather elegantly, like this one. This is what the sun will look like in about 6 billion years when it runs out of fuel. Some in a less elegant way. This is another dying star throwing off part of its material. And some stars, the bigger ones, die explosively. This is a famous object called the Crab Nebula, which is the expanding debris from an explosion witnessed and recorded by Chinese astronomers in the year 1054 AD. They report that a guest star had appeared, becoming as bright as the moon, and then faded away. And now, in this place, we see this expanding cloud of debris. Well, these supernovae may seem far away and long ago, but they're very important. Were it not for these supernovae, we wouldn't be here. Because in the course of its lifetime, a star derives its energy from nuclear fusion. It turns hydrogen to helium, helium into carbon, into oxygen, and into iron. And then it throws back into space all that processed material from which new stars then form. So what's actually going on in interstellar space is rather like an ecological process. Don't worry about the details of this, but this indicates how stars form from gas. They evolve, they spew back their material into interstellar space, and then new stars form from it. And by this process, we can understand how pristine hydrogen was forged into all the elements of the periodic table. And we can also infer that inside each of us, we're made of carbon, phosphorus, oxygen, etc., there are atoms that came from thousands of different exploding stars spread throughout the Milky Way. So we are linked to the cosmos in a very intimate way. The cosmos is part of our environment. And this theory can explain the relative proportions. This is a slightly technical slide which shows the relative proportions in which the different elements exist. And by calculating how stars evolve, we can understand why carbon, oxygen, and iron are common, but gold and uranium are rare, and how they all came to be in our solar system. In this galactic perspective of stars forming, evolving, and dying, how unique is our Earth? How unique is our solar system? Planets, we expect, are common. This is an artist's impression, not a real picture. It shows how we think a star forms. It contracts from a cloud of dusty gas. If the gas has even a bit of spin, as it contracts, it spins up, like the ballerina pulling in her arms. And it will form a protostar, and spun off around it will be a dusty disk from which planets form. We believe that's how our solar system formed, and we believe this is a generic process, so astronomers have thought for quite a long time that planets ought to be common around other stars, just as they are around our star, the Sun. But only recently have we found direct evidence for planets around other stars. And this evidence has come indirectly, not by viewing the planet, but by viewing the effect of the planet on the motion of the star. This simple diagram shows a star with a planet orbiting it, and what actually happens, of course, is the star and the planet both orbit around their center of mass, what's called the barycenter. The planet moves in a big orbit, and the Sun, being heavier, moves in a smaller circle. And it's possible to measure these small motions in a star and infer that they are induced by the pull of an orbiting planet. And by this technique, several hundred stars have already been discovered to have planets. Don't worry about this. This is just a list of a number of stars which are known to have at least two planets inferred by this technique. Now, the planets inferred by this technique are big ones, rather like Jupiter and Saturn, the giants of our solar system. It's harder to detect a planet like the Earth, because the Earth would induce a motion of only a few centimeters per second in the motion of its central star, and that's too small to be detected by these techniques. But we'd really like to find evidence for Earth-like planets. And in fact, we will have some evidence very soon from a spacecraft launched last year called Kepler. What Kepler is doing is it's pointing at a patch of sky about 7 degrees across, and every half hour it's measuring the brightness of the thousands of stars in that part of the sky to a precision of better than 1 part in 10,000. And it's looking for cases when something like this happens, when a star gets slightly fainter, as would happen if a planet transits in front of it. And if you can measure the brightness of a star to 1 part in 10,000, you can detect a planet covering only 1/10,000th of the face of the star, an Earth-like planet around another star. Within a couple of years, we expect that the Kepler scientists will announce quite a large number of Earth-like planets orbiting other stars. And of course, for every one they find, simple geometry says there'll probably 50 or 100 more, because you only see this effect if we are looking more or less in the plane of the orbit. Well, one would really, of course, like not just to infer the shadow of an Earth-like planet, but to see it directly. And that's hard. To recognize how hard, let's suppose an alien astronomer with a powerful telescope was viewing the Earth and the Sun from, say, 30 light years away, the distance of a nearby star. Well, to those alien astronomers, the Sun would look an ordinary star, and the Earth would look, in Carl Sagan's nice phrase, a pale blue dot, very close in the sky to its star, our Sun, and billions of times fainter. One is looking for a firefly next to a searchlight, as it were, a very hard thing to detect. But if the planet could be detected, if these aliens could detect the Earth, then by watching the pale blue dot, they could infer quite a bit about it. Because the shade of blue would be slightly different depending on whether the Pacific Ocean or the landmass of Asia was facing them. So they could infer the length of the day, that there were continents, something of the climate, and something of the seasons. Well, within 20 years, we will be doing this for Earth-like planets orbiting other stars, using either large arrays in space like this, or possibly the next generation of giant telescopes on the ground. This You see the scale from the truck in the bottom left. This is the kind of telescope which European astronomers hope to build, probably in Chile. Well, 20 years from now, we hope we will be imaging Earth-like planets, but will there be life on any of them? We can't answer this question because we know too little about how life began here on Earth. We don't know how life began on Earth, although we know, once it did begin, how it evolved. So we can't therefore say whether life is something that always happens given conditions like those on the young Earth, or whether it's a rare fluke that wouldn't have happened. But the quest for alien life is a fascinating challenge, and its outcome will influence our concept of our place in nature as profoundly as Darwinism has over the last 150 years. But we shouldn't hold our breath for success. What about in our own solar system? 100 years ago, many people thought that Mars was inhabited. And 200 years ago, some people thought the Sun was as well. In fact, there was a prize given by a French foundation in the year 1900 for finding evidence of life elsewhere. And in the condition of the prize, Mars was excluded. It was thought too easy to find life on Mars. We've now become more cautious. There could be some freeze-dried bugs on Mars. There could be some life beneath the ice on Europa, the moon of Jupiter. But we're not hopeful about any life, and certainly nothing beyond very simple life anywhere in our solar system. To look for complex life, we need to look far beyond to the other planets orbiting other stars. And in our current ignorance, it would make sense to focus on Earth-like planets, the kind which will be discovered quite soon. Simply because we don't know. We know it happened once here, so one should look for similar conditions. Now, many people have noted that the Earth is rather special, and that's a list of special things which have been adduced as necessary conditions for the evolution of life. I would urge not to take these conditions too seriously. It may be that life can exist under a wider range of conditions. We've evolved to cope with these conditions, but that's because that's where we are. It's like saying, isn't it amazing that our legs are just long enough to reach the ground? You know, that's not amazing. And it may not be amazing that we fit the Earth's environment so well, and perhaps there are balloon-like creatures floating in the dense atmospheres of Jupiter-like planets, and of course science fiction writers have other ideas. And incidentally, it's better to read first-rate science fiction like Arthur C. Clarke's than second-rate science. I advise my students of this. The second-rate science is no more likely to be true, and it is much less interesting. Well, as regards where to look for life and how likely it is, then we just don't know. The biological issues are much more complicated. And even if simple life is common, even if life gets started in any Earth-like environment, it's of course a separate question whether it's likely to evolve into anything we might recognize as intelligent or complex. There's a lot of debate about if evolution were rerun on the Earth. Would we end up with humans or just reptiles or just insects or something? There's a big debate about whether evolution is convergent or not. And so we don't know whether advanced life would exist even if simple life does. Of course, as a digression, I should mention that there are some people who think they know the answer. In fact, I get letters from people who think they've been visited by aliens. I tend to get such people to write to each other. And if I write to them, I say, well, if the aliens had made the tremendous technological effort to come here across interstellar space, what a pity they only made a few corn circles and went away again, and what a pity they only met a few well-known cranks. It seems a pity. Well, I don't think that the aliens have visited, but perhaps one day we will detect a signal from space that's clearly artificial. Even if it's rather boring, a list of prime numbers or the digits of pi, it would carry the momentous message that concepts of logic and physics, if not consciousness, aren't limited to the hardware in human skulls. But if we did detect such a message, we would have some kind of common culture. Because even if the aliens lived on planet Zog and had seven tentacles, they'd be made of the same kind of atoms as us. They'd gaze out, if they had eyes, at the same cosmos as us. They'd trace their origins back to the same Big Bang. But even if we could make contacts, any aliens would be so far away that signals would take many years to travel each way. No scope, therefore, for snappy repartee. On the other hand, perhaps such searches will fail. Perhaps there's no galactic community to plug into. Moreover, even if intelligence were widespread, we may never become aware of more than a small and atypical fraction of what's out there. Some brains may package reality in a fashion that we can't conceive. Others could be leading contemplative lives, doing nothing to reveal their presence. Absence of evidence wouldn't be evidence of absence, because the only type of intelligence we could detect would be one that led to a technology or some kind of artifacts that we could recognize as such. Well, so much for life for the moment. Let me now turn back to the inanimate cosmos and let me enlarge our horizons further. If we could get 2 million light years away from the Earth and look back, we'd see something like this. This, as many of you probably know, is Andromeda, the brightest external galaxy to our own. It's a spinning disk viewed obliquely, containing about 100 billion stars, all spinning around a central hub. Our own galaxy, the Milky Way, is like this, the Earth being about two-thirds of the way out from the center. And this is just one of the many galaxies we can see with our telescopes. Here's another nearby one. Now, of course, astronomers are frustrated because they can't do experiments on their subject matter. They can just observe. But they can do experiments in a virtual universe in their computer. They can ask, what would happen if we crashed two galaxies together? And in their computer, they can calculate it. And this is what would happen. Each raises tides on the other, and the gravity shears it out into a very complicated pattern. We then look into space, and we see not just galaxies like the first two I showed you, but systems like this. And having done a lot of computer modeling, one can infer that this is a case when two galaxies have got dangerously close, each has raised tides on the other, leading to that filament of ejected material. And so by calculations of this kind, we can infer galaxies' dynamics, what they're made of, what their mass is, etc. And for that reason, we can be quite confident, even though we can't do direct experiments in our understanding of galaxies. And huge numbers of galaxies are available for study. This is a map of the nearest 1,000 million light years of all the galaxies around us. And this is done by the Anglo-Australian Telescope, and what you see here is the galaxies out to a distance of about a billion light years. They're not uniform, they're grouped together in clusters, but they go as far as you can see, and of course they fade away, they're too faint at great distances. One thing we do know, and we've known since the 1930s, is that distant galaxies are moving away from us, and the further from us they are, the faster they're moving. It's rather like this system of arrows. The further away the galaxy is, the longer the arrow, the faster it's moving. This is the so-called Hubble law, discovered by Edwin Hubble. Heavy smoker, as you can see in this picture. He discovered that galaxies are receding at a speed proportional to their distance. Now, at first sight, you might think this implies we're in some sort of central position, but it doesn't, as I can illustrate from this picture. Imagine that all the rods on this infinite network lengthened. And if you sat on one vertex, you would see the other vertices moving away at a speed proportional to the number of intervening links. The whole thing would expand. And there'd be no special center. Now, this is a good picture for the expanding universe, although, as you saw, the galaxies weren't in a regular pattern. If you imagine clusters of galaxies all joined by rods, the rods all lengthen at the same rate, and that's a good picture for the expanding universe. It's good, except that it misses out one feature, which is exemplified better by this second Escher picture, angel and devils. The feature that the early picture missed out is that when we look a long way out into space, we are looking far back in time to an era when the universe was more compressed, when the rods were shorter. So what we actually see if we look back out along our past light cone, as it's called, is we see the early, the distant parts of the universe as they were when they were more compressed, rather like as depicted here, when we look towards the horizon and everything gets smaller and more closer packed. And this is one technical picture. This is a tracing of the spectrum of the light from three very distant galaxies. And the reason I show this is that the emission, the strongest emission line, it's the famous Lyman alpha line of hydrogen, which physicists will know is in the far ultraviolet, 1216 angstroms. In these three objects, it's at nearly 9,000 angstroms, not in the far ultraviolet, but in the red part of the visible spectrum. The redshift here is a factor of 7, which indicates that the universe is stretched by a factor of 7 from the time when that light set out to when it reached us. So we can look very far away. And this amazing picture shows a small patch of sky, just a few arc minutes across, so small it would take about 100 patches like this to cover the full moon. And looked at through a modest-sized telescope, this would look just blank. But with a very big telescope, you see these hundreds of smudges. Each of these is actually an entire galaxy, which appears so small and faint because of its huge distance. The light from these remote galaxies set out towards us 10 billion years ago, long before the Earth formed. They're being viewed when they themselves have only just formed. Some of these young galaxies consist mainly of glowing diffuse gas that hasn't yet turned into stars. When we look at Andromeda, we might wonder whether there are aliens looking back at us. Perhaps there are. But the light we see from these ultra-remote galaxies set out before there'd been time for stars to forge the silicon, carbon, and oxygen needed even to make planets. So the scant chance of life back then. When people are told that the universe started off in a dense amorphous state and it expanded and developed this intricate structure, those who know some physics get perplexed because they've probably heard of what's called the second law of thermodynamics, which indicates that normally order gets washed out with time. And what seems to happen in the expanded universe is the opposite. Why is that? The answer is it's the effect of gravity. If you imagine the universe starting off, everything close packed and dense, and if you imagine that some bits were just slightly denser than average, then as the universe expands, the slightly over-dense bits would lag behind more and more. Gravity would decelerate them more, and the density contrast would grow. And by this process, from an early universe that's almost smooth, you can have structure developing. And I'm going to show you a movie, another simulation, which shows a volume of the universe large enough to make several hundred galaxies. And the expansion of the universe is subtracted out, so it looks the same size all the time, but you see the structure forming. And bottom left is the time measured in billions of years. And so as the universe is expanding, but relative to the expanding frame, structure is condensing out. Gravity is enhancing the density contrast. And that you end up with a structure rather like what we see today. So that's a simulation speeded up by a factor of 10 to the 16 from real time, so that you can see it before the end of a lecture. Okay. Yeah. If I needed a logo for my research group, I'd choose this, an Ouroboros. This image depicts rather nicely the interconnectedness of the microworld on the left and the cosmos on the right, the inner space of atoms and the outer space of the universe. And there are links between small and large, left and right. Our everyday world of life and mountains is determined by atoms and the chemistry. Higher up in the picture, there's another link, because stars, on the right, halfway up, are powered by nuclear physics. Nuclei halfway up on the left. And higher up in the picture still, there's another link, which I haven't had time to address, because galaxies are seemingly held together not just by the gravity of what you see, but by a swarm of subnuclear particles that make up the dark matter. So there's a link between subnuclear particles up on the left and galaxies up there on the right. The left-hand side is the domain of the quantum. On the right-hand side, Einstein's theory holds sway. Now, general relativity, Einstein's theory, and quantum theory are the two great pillars of 20th century physics. But they haven't yet been meshed together into a single unified theory. In most contexts, this doesn't matter. It doesn't impede us because their domains of relevance don't overlap. Astronomers can ignore quantum fuzziness when they're thinking about the orbits of a planet. On the other hand, chemists could ignore the gravitational pull between the individual atoms in a molecule because it's nearly 40 powers of 10 weaker than the electrical forces between those atoms. But at the very beginning of the universe, everything was squeezed so small that quantum fluctuations could, as it were, shake the entire universe. And so to confront the overwhelming mystery of what banged and why it banged, we need a unified theory of cosmos and microworld, symbolized, as it were, gastronomically at the top of this diagram here. And to put this on a firm footing, we will need to understand the very large and the very small and how they link together. But before I leave this picture, I should mention that apart from the very large and the very small, there's a third frontier, the very complex. And we ourselves are the most complex things we know about in the universe, and we are midway between atoms and stars. We're large enough compared to atoms to have layer upon layer of intricate structure, but not so large that we are crushed by our planet's gravity. To understand ourselves, we must understand the atoms we're made of, and we must understand the stars that made those atoms. We are, in a rather precise sense, halfway between atoms and stars. The geometric mean of the mass of a proton and the mass of the sun is about 50 kilograms. Within a factor of two of the mass of each person here. So it takes as many human bodies to make up the sun as there are atoms in each of us. Stars are simple, just like atoms are simple. Stars are simple because they're so big and hot that their content is broken down into simple atoms. There's no complex chemistry inside a star. And they don't match the intricate structure of even an insect, let alone the human brain. And for historical interest, I put this famous drawing of a flea. And this was drawn in the 1660s by Robert Hooke, who was the first person to draw these animals through a microscope. And he published a book that became the Royal Society's first bestseller, Micrographia, where he showed pictures of all these organisms. And this is his wonderful drawing of a flea. And as is clear from him, and he wondered at the fact that the intricacy on a small scale of these animals was far greater than the intricacy of anything inanimate at the time. Hazard a warning light. I'm going to make a couple of remarks that are very speculative. First, let's ask, how big is the universe? Is it even bigger than what we can observe? Well, as you saw, we can observe a huge volume of space. We can observe those galaxies out to 10 billion light years away. It's a huge volume, but a finite volume. And it's bounded like a horizon, because the light from further away can't get to us. But there's no particular reason to think that that's the end of the universe, any more than if you're in the middle of an ocean and you look around at the horizon, you think the ocean ends just beyond the horizon. In fact, there are very strong reasons for thinking that the universe goes on much further than we can see. The reason for that is that if we look as far as we can in that direction, and as far as we can in that direction, conditions don't differ by more than one part in 100,000. So that suggests that any gradient across the grand cosmos is very small indeed. So there does seem to be good reason for thinking there's a lot more to our universe than we can see. And it could go much, much, much further. And there are some theories that suggest it does, 10 to the power 100 light years, or even so far that every combinatorial option is fulfilled. And there's another lecture room somewhere else with people here listening to a lecture. That could be the case if it goes on far enough, but that would be far, far, far beyond our horizon. Within our horizon, you can't have all those options. But that's not all. What I've talked about so far is the aftermath of our Big Bang. But our Big Bang, and again, remember the hazard sign, this is speculation, may not be the only one. One option is what's called here brain worlds, the idea of many universes embedded in a higher dimensional space. To illustrate this, let's imagine on this sheet of paper you have a lot of ants crawling around, and they think this is their two-dimensional universe. They might be unaware of another population of ants on a parallel sheet of paper. Likewise, it's not inconceivable that there could be another universe just that far away from us, which we are unaware of, if that distance is measured in some fourth spatial dimension and we're imprisoned in R3. So that's one version of the so-called multiverse theory. And there's another idea called eternal inflation, that's symbolized by this cartoon, where our universe and its horizon is the bottom right, but this could be, in a sense, just one part of some grand ensemble of disconnected regions of space and time. And these ideas are on the speculative fringes of cosmology, but they are speculative science, not just metaphysics, but I believe that one day we will know enough about our Big Bang and the extreme physics that happened there to know how large physical reality is, how far it extends beyond the region we can see. Back now to life in space. If the SETI searches, the searches for extraterrestrial intelligence, are doomed to fail, if we are alone in the galaxy, this may seem disappointing. But it would have its upside. It would boost our cosmic self-esteem. Because if our tiny Earth were a unique abode of intelligence in the Milky Way, then humanity would have greater cosmic significance than it would merit if the galaxy already teemed with complex life. Nor would it mean that life was forever a trivial afterthought in the cosmos. And that's because of the vast time that lies ahead. Most people are aware that we are the outcome of billions of years of Darwinian evolution. Simple time chart, rather like that. But it's still commonly thought, I think, by most people who are aware of this, that somehow we humans are the culmination of the evolutionary tree. But no astronomer could believe that. This is a drawing of the sun's life cycle, sort of time lapse starting and evolving to its end. And the sun is not quite halfway through its life. It formed from an interstellar cloud 4.5 billion years ago. It's been burning hydrogen, and it's have another 5 or 6 billion years to go before the fuel runs out. The sun is less than halfway through its life. And the expanding universe may continue even longer, perhaps forever. And as Woody Allen said, eternity is very long, especially towards the end. So, from this picture, it's a tenable view that we are barely at the halfway stage of evolutionary development. And any creature witnessing the sun's demise 6 billion years hence, here on Earth or far beyond, won't be human. They were as different from us as we are from a bug. Even Darwin realized that it would be future evolution, and it could be very extreme. So the creatures that send this postcard could be as different from us as we are from a bug, because they will have had 6 billion years to evolve. And moreover, there are reasons to expect that future evolution is going to be much faster than Darwinian, because Darwinian was very slow by natural selection, whereas future evolution in the post-human era could be far faster because it is controlled on the technological timescale. So for that reason also, future evolution could be far more dramatic and varied here on Earth and far beyond than what's happened up till now. Well, I now want to focus in back on the Earth. Because even in this concertina timeline, extending billions of years into the future as well as billions of years into the past, I want to explain that this century may be a defining moment. It's the first in our planet's history where one species, ours, has Earth's future in its hands and could jeopardize not only life itself, but life's immense potential. We've been familiar since the 1960s with pictures of the Earth seen by space. Its fragile biosphere, contrasting with the sterile moonscape where Neil Armstrong and the others left their footprints. But suppose some aliens had been watching our planet for its entire history. What would they have seen? Over nearly all that huge time span, 4.5 billion years, Earth's appearance would have altered very gradually. The continents drifted, the ice cover waxed and waned, successive species emerged, evolved, and became extinct. But in just a tiny sliver of the Earth's history, the last 1 millionth part, just a few thousand years, the patterns of vegetation altered much faster than before. This signaled the start of agriculture, and the pace of change accelerated as human populations rose. But then there were other changes, even faster. Within 50 years, little more than 1/100 of 1 millionth of the Earth's age, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere began to rise enormously fast, and the planet became an intense emitter of radio waves, the total output of all TVs, radars, and cell phones. And something else unprecedented would have been seen by the aliens. For the first time in Earth's history, projectiles left the surface of the planet. Some went into orbit around it, some went to the moon, some were propelled even further. If they understood astrophysics, the aliens could confidently predict that the biosphere would face doom in a few billion years when the sun flares up and dies. But could they have predicted this unprecedented fever less than halfway through the Earth's life, these human-induced alterations occupying overall less than a millionth of the elapsed lifetime and seemingly occurring with runaway speed? Well, if they continued to keep watch, what might these aliens witness in the next 100 years? Will a final spasm be followed by silence? Or will the planet itself stabilize? And will some of the objects launched from the Earth spawn new oases of life elsewhere? Well, the choice depends on us this century, and whether you're an astronomer or not, there's an important message. Earth is a very special place, and we're its stewards at a special time. Thank you very much.
For some time now, the university community has eagerly awaited your lecture tonight. Indeed, so overwhelmed was I by the moment I failed to acknowledge His Excellency, the Governor David de Kretser, at the start, and delighted that he and Jan de Kretser, like our Prime Minister, are here simply because they're fascinated with the subject that you've introduced tonight. People have come in large numbers to hear you, and let me say, you have not disappointed. I hope that young scientists, in particular listening tonight, have found ample evidence of the extraordinary broad powers of an argument that an accomplished science may possess. You've ranged widely, as befits a cosmologist, and opened for us perspectives on the challenges of the present and the future. And if I may say so, Lord Rees, one of the striking features of your work is that you challenge us to think from an ethical viewpoint about the work of science, far from being neutral value territory. The great force and power of scientific technology forces us to think morally, and you've invited us to do that, to think morally about the future of humanity and the planet. This need for moral reasoning is a primary concern of education, and I think in Lord Rees we have an exemplar in the field. So on behalf of all of us tonight who've been privileged to hear you, may I invite our audience to say thank you for the extraordinary example you set as an educator and a scientist. And if we may commemorate in this way an extraordinarily memorable first Derek Denton lecture. Thank you all.
Okay, well, thank you.